Hello. The recent cooling in the weather is a reminder of the imminent change in seasons. So on this week's program, we're paying our final visit this year to the Jersey Shore. We'll speak with Temple University history professor Brian Simon. He's the author of Boardwalk of Dreams, Atlantic City and the Fate of Urban America. Susan Lewis explores a movement to preserve the so-called doo-wop architecture in Wildwood. We visit Lucy the Elephant in Margate, and Jason Pfeiffer explores Cape May's vibrant theatre scene. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Temple University history professor Brian Simon has recently been the subject of much national media attention for a book he's writing about the coffee shop chain Starbucks. His first book, Boardwalk of Dreams, Atlantic City and the Fate of Urban America, received similar national attention. During the first half of the 20th century, Atlantic City was the nation's most popular middle-class resort, the home of the famed Boardwalk, the Miss America pageant, and the board game Monopoly. By the 1960s, it had become a symbol of urban decay and blight. In his wide-ranging book, Simon does far more than tell a nostalgic tale of Atlantic City's rise, near death, and reincarnation. He turns the depiction of middle-class vacationers into a revealing discussion of the boundaries of public space in urban America. Brian Simon came into our studios recently to talk about Boardwalk of Dreams. Of all the Jersey Shore towns, how come Atlantic City ended up with this amazingly storied history? How did it start off and how did it achieve such popularity at an early stage in the basically the vacation industry?
That's actually a pretty simple question. It's one of proximity. Atlantic City was the closest place between Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore, and railroad developers pulled out a map, drew a line, and decided where it was going to be. So it wasn't happenstance, it was geography. And they decided that if they could lay a railroad track, they could create a shore town more for the masses. And that's exactly what happened. It was a speculation bid by boosters who laid railroad track between Philadelphia and Atlantic City and decided that they might start excursions for the developing middle class of booming Philadelphia.
The casinos were to come later, but the great entertainment that was down there, there was a lot of great jazz musicians. The Rat Pack spent time down there and entertained in the hotels. You describe in your book the fact that Atlantic City, pre-1960s, was effectively a Jim Crow town.
Well, those are two stories, but they're closely related. Atlantic City becomes, I think, really quickly, at least by the turn of the century, almost Disneyland before there was Disneyland. Before the Rat Pack came, you know, not even Guy Lombardo, but Armstrong came, John Philip Sousa.
Right.
Came.
Oh, of course, yeah. So, and would regularly bring his orchestra there to stay for some...
For almost the whole summer.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really the first great middle-class resort in America, and masses of people came. The buildings were much more, I think, fantastic than Disney would ever create. Maybe not as fantastic as Coney Island, but truly a kind of wonderland at the beach. Now, in order for that to happen, and this is a kind of key point to me, the town had to be segregated. It couldn't, in early America, attract the masses without keeping some people out. You couldn't demonstrate your middle classness, your inclusion in America, and for some immigrants, your inclusion in whiteness without keeping African Americans out. So the segregation of Atlantic City was not incidental in any way. It was, in fact, the precondition for the city's emergence as a mass resort. Now, this is also really important. African Americans were segregated in where they lived and where they worked, but they were put on display. African Americans were used in Atlantic City. Much of the entertainment was blackface, minstrelsy, which was the kind of staple of vaudeville until the 1950s. But also African Americans were put on display as bellhops, as shoe shiners, and most importantly, Atlantic City, they push people down the boardwalk in rolling chairs, these sort of chariot-like
wicker chairs
down this flat, easy-to-walk boardwalk. Now, all of this was to demonstrate to the middle class that they had made it in America, made it like the rich so that they could dominate and hire and control African Americans. And Atlantic City offered that spectacle of fantasy but also racial dominance at a relatively cheap price.
Ironically, then, it was the 1960s and the civil rights movement, which was to be the undoing of Atlantic City as this type of resort. Can you talk about how the city's popularity then decreased as African-Americans started to gain civil rights?
In a kind of cruel irony, and an irony that gets played out again and again in the United States, desegregation leads to the collapse of places. In other words, once places get too democratic, that anyone can go, the middle class, largely white, flees. And we know this story in the suburbs and in the cities. Well, this happens in resort towns as well. When African Americans who themselves want to share in their newfound benefits of better jobs, better access, come to Atlantic City to imitate immigrants from 50 years before, immigrants see them, and not everyone, but large numbers of them just leave.
We have then a city in decline between the late 60s and the coming of the casinos in the late 70s. Was it not the case that local officials believed that bringing gambling to Atlantic City would reinvigorate the city as a whole and help to bring about the revitalization of its various neighborhoods?
No, I mean, Atlantic City was, as you pointed out, a place with what people have called urban villages, little cities within a city. And some of those, like Ducktown, survived all the way till gambling came. And the night that the gambling referendum passed, people literally danced in the streets of Atlantic City. The bars threw open their doors, gave away drinks because they believed that yesterday was going to come again. Some of those promises came true, but for the city itself, it's been largely eviscerated by gambling. As a place to live, as a place to work, as a place of culture, for the residents of the city, that city doesn't exist so much anymore.
And why is it then that gambling hasn't, in your opinion, helped to reinvigorate the local economy through this kind of trickle-down economics?
Well, it's not just that. I mean, in terms of urban form and amenities, gambling's been a kind of bust. I mean, if you look at it, 200 restaurants have gone out of business since the casinos came. Until last year, Atlantic City, which once had 15 huge movie theaters, didn't have a single movie theater, despite attracting 35 million visitors a year. It has a beautiful baseball stadium on the bay that barely can get 1,000 people a night, despite, you know, being a kind of really wonderful place to watch a baseball game. And why is that? That's because gambling is fundamentally opposed to what we think of as city development. Casinos are in the business of locking people inside and taking all their money. I mean, I'm not suggesting this is a shakedown, but that's what they do. What cities thrive on is that trickle down from businesses that would, you know, go to the local bar, would go to the local corner store. But again, gambling as a principle is meant to lock people inside. And that's why you can have this tremendous development at these 12 casinos and very little trickle down to the rest of the city because of the way that's supposed to work.
Brian Simon, Boardwalk of Dreams, Atlantic City and the Fate of Urban America is published by Oxford University Press.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
All along the South Jersey shore, ocean waves lap at flat, white, sandy beaches. But once you shake out the towels, pack up the buckets, shovels, chairs and umbrellas, you start to realize that each shore town has its own distinctive character, personality and look. Atlantic City has its casino glitz, Cape May with its Victorian charm, and somewhere in between, Wildwood, or more accurately, the cluster of communities known as the Wildwoods, is marketing an identity beyond the amusement parks and bars, as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports.
Earth Angel, will you be mine? My darling dear, love you all the time. I'm just a fool in love with you.
That's the Penguins' Earth Angel, said to be the first pure doo-wop record. It blends pop melodies and the lyrical innocence of the 1950s with the emotional syntax of gospel and R&B. Now Wildwood is staking its claim to doo-wop architecture. That's what a group of civic-minded Wildwood residents decided to call the style of buildings, particularly motels, that went up during Wildwood's building boom of the same time, says Charles Schumann, a member of the Doo-Wop Preservation League.
The war ended. People had money in their pockets. They bought a car. They could drive to Wildwood. They needed places to stay, which developed the motel districts. And it was all done in the 50s and 60s and followed the design that was popular then.
But as time passed, the charm of these funky motels faded for succeeding generations of vacationers. By the 1990s, many of Wildwood's over 300 doo-wop-style motels were gone or in danger of being swept away by new construction. An architect named Steve Eisenhower helped change the tide, according to a protege of his, architect Richard Stokes. Stokes says that when Eisenhower studied Wildwood, he discovered, academically speaking, a plethora of 1950s design and helped support the case that this architecture could be a civic asset.
He got the resort to rethink about how they saw the motels, the buildings, in that it was a more important piece of American history that should not be thrown in the trash heap like a lot of other such places.
The Duop Preservation League rallied with a mission to protect Wildwood's distinctive 50s urban landscape, just as Cape May had nurtured its Victorian-era roots. And the label Duop? Chuck Schumann says that name came up when the Preservation League joined with the Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts to put together its first tour of Wildwood.
We had to have a way of describing that architect because we weren't really pleased with some of the other terms, Jetson and et cetera. And after doing a little research, we realized that the term doo-wop was used in background music from Philadelphia during the 50s. So we added it to our definition of the architect in Wildwood.
Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender, pretending that I'm doing well. My need is such, I pretend too much. I'm lonely, but no one can tell.
If you're wondering how soulful harmonies translate to glass and steel, the architecture is described by Richard Stokes as mid-century modern.
California, it's known as Googie style. And, Miami, it's known as Mimo. So every locality sort of has its own name for this fun 1950s vintage optimistic modern architecture.
In Wildwood, this 50s optimism was expressed in motels that played with zany loud colors like aqua and purple, unusual shapes, bright signage, and futuristic themes like the Astronaut Hotel, or exotic places you might like to visit if your budget didn't limit you to the Jersey Shore. And so motels sprung up with names like the Tahiti, the Singapore, the Royal Hawaiian. Stokes says that many of the owners had Miami Beach in mind, modified in terms of cost because of Wildwood's shorter season. And whichever theme took hold, the layout of each motel, or motor hotel, paid homage to the object of America's newest passion and the love affair that made all of this development possible in the first place.
It's all about the car here. People had newly purchased cars, and so these motels actually showed off the car. People wanted to park right in front of their units. They didn't want to hide it.
Ilan Zingman Leith, a former board member of the Duop Preservation League, says that the car was the focus of a whole new sensibility.
The freedom of not taking the train to go on vacation, which is what people did before World War II, was very new, and it was a new class of middle-class people. They were nouveau riche, and they liked to show off, and they had decorations. Plain, simple, tasteful was not the style of the 50s.
Leith now sits on the board of the Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts and is curator of this summer's exhibit on doo-wop style at the center's carriage house. He says that his interest is in social history, and the exhibit relates the doo-wop design to the whole way of life at the time.
1950s music, 1950s television, 1950s politics, the Red Scare, integration, all these parts of life showed up in movies, in music, and really showed up in furniture and in architecture too. This futuristic aesthetic was a part of the 50s and was really a turning away from early American and historical stuff that was before World War II.
And so the Duop preservationists press on. The National Trust for Historic Preservation named Wildwood's Duop Motels to its 2006 list of most endangered historic places. The Duop Preservation League has published a book on how to create and maintain a Duop style and issues guidelines for developers in the hopes that voluntary compliance will nudge the community forward, or backward, but in a new way. Because the goal was not to go back in time and replicate exactly the facilities of the 50s, but rather to save a slice of social history and adapt it for the future. And Chuck Schumann says that thanks to the efforts of the Duop Preservation League, the new Duop is not just limited to motel renovations. Other businesses are catching the wave.
The Acme has just built a brand new Acme, and it's Duop. The building's done in light blue and white, and off-color blue, the Duop blue. Wawa altered their exterior design of the building to be Duop with lots of stainless steel. Commerce Bank built a brand new bank in Wildwood with a great Duop sign, lots of neon.
So what's all this have to do with its musical namesake? Maybe not a lot, but just enough. With common roots, a shared history, and an enduring enthusiasm for exuberant fun, which is perhaps what the shore, or at least this part of it, is all about.
She wore blue velvet.
WRTI, Susan Lewis.
Bluer than velvet was the night.
This fall, the Wildwood Preservation League plans to open a new museum dedicated to the doo-wop style. In the meantime, the exhibition at the Carriage House Gallery of the Mid-Atlantic Center for the Arts runs through September 3rd.
She wore blue velvet, and as the night danced slowly by, warmer than May, her tender sighs. Love was high, and I still can see blue velvet
through my tears.
I still can see blue velvet through my tears.
When you think of wildlife at the Jersey Shore, you're probably thinking seagulls and maybe a cat or two pacing the docks. But one of the most famous animals at the Jersey Shore is an elephant. Standing 65 feet tall, weighing 90 tons, is Lucy the elephant. And she's old, 125 years to be exact. But this doesn't mean she's lost her spark.
Lucy is so unique. There's nothing like her else anywhere else on Earth.
Richard Halfand is executive director of Lucy, who, all right, is not actually a living, breathing pachyderm, but she is actually a National Historic Landmark. The technical name for a building shaped like an animal is zoomorphic architecture, and Lucy is the country's oldest surviving example of this. What may seem weird about Lucy by today's real estate standards is why a giant elephant made of wood and tin stands on precious beachfront property. Richard Helfand explains that Lucy came into being as a result of a 19th century marketing scheme. Margate was not yet a town, and the land was underdeveloped and fairly undiscovered by tourists. A Philadelphia real estate entrepreneur named James Lafferty came up with a plan to change all this.
He owned this land, and he came up with a gimmick of building a mammoth elephant, fashioned after P.T. Barnum's Jumbo, to lure prospective land buyers down from Atlantic City, which was booming in the late 1800s, to sell off his holdings. And that's how Lucy came to be.
And it worked. People came to this part of what was then South Atlantic City to see the six-story building shaped like an elephant. Lafferty's real estate office was at the bottom of Lucy, and prospective customers could climb up the stairway in her leg, walk around her stomach and head outside to the howdah, the viewing area on her back. From Lucy's back, they could survey the land that was for sale. The young real estate entrepreneur quickly sold off his property, but Lucy's work wasn't yet done. Her creator did build two other elephants in his career. As a matter of fact, no one else could. He had a patent on buildings shaped like animals for 17 years. One elephant stood 12 stories high in Coney Island. The other, the smallest of the three, was in Cape May. Lucy is now the only survivor. Lucy remained peering out at the Atlantic Ocean long after beachfront property was a tough sell. She was a private home and a tavern, but in her longest incarnation from 1904 to 1962, she was a tourist attraction. But like many divas before her, as times changed, Lucy had some tough luck.
The area was in a bad way. Atlantic City was in a major decline by then. It was really a very desolate, desperate town, and so goes Atlantic City, so goes the region. And Lucy was actually condemned by the building department for the city of Margate as being unsafe for people to go through. So it sat dormant from 62 to 69 and just continued to rot.
No longer wanting to deal with a deteriorating 65-foot elephant in a town going south, Lucy's owners moved to Florida, selling the land where Lucy stood to a developer and donating the elephant to the town of Margate. In 1970, Lucy was carefully moved two blocks south to beachfront property owned by the city. Moving a 90-ton elephant even just two blocks is quite a feat. As Lucy's tour director, Marsha Lee Gowdy, explains...
She held up well, even though she was so decrepit and in sad shape. but her tongue fell out. And so we have the original tongue in the window there for everyone to see.
And there it is, a giant pink tongue about as large as a child's sled. We're inside the belly of Lucy, which serves as a museum. On the flesh-colored walls, there are black and white photos documenting Lucy's past and her many stages of restoration. Walk over to her head and you can peek through Lucy's eyes, which are windows, and you see what Lucy sees, which incidentally is a really fantastic view of the Atlantic Ocean.
Each year, tens of thousands of visitors of all ages come to see Lucy.
An 8-minute video plays inside the belly of the beast, offering more information than you ever thought you'd need to know about an elephant-shaped building. In the summer, there are tours every 30 minutes, but hard times are not over for New Jersey's favorite elephant, as Marsha Lee Gowdy admits.
Lucy's a work in progress because she needs constant maintenance. And she's once again beautiful, thanks to the Save Lucy Committee.
And for Executive Director Rich Helfand, the cost of maintaining Lucy is a constant battle, which he doesn't always feel he's winning.
There are monuments, there are museums, there are lighthouses, there are old historic buildings, but there's only one elephant building on Earth. She's very special. She's very, very unique. And the fact that so many people take her for granted and don't support her as they should to have a national monument right here in their backyard is kind of disheartening.
Lucy is operated by the non-profit Save Lucy Committee, and the beachfront property she stands on is owned by the city of Margate. Although the two don't always see eye to eye, for now Lucy is safe, and Helfand says the Save Lucy Committee will do what they can to keep her this way.
Lucy stands for a lot of things to us. Lucy is about history. She's a testament to what man can do with imagination. She's a piece of Americana. She's a part of the fabric of America. You know, when you look through her eyes, it's a porthole into our past. And she's a beacon into our future of what you can do with imagination and determination. And she's also a symbol of what almost was lost, because she came this close to being, you know, a victim of the wrecking ball.
Down in Margate by the sea, we can make a memory at Lucy the Elephant, Lucy the Elephant.
Down by the sea,
Lucy the Elephant, Lucy the Elephant.
So come see me.
You can find Lucy the Elephant at 9200 Atlantic Avenue, Margate. She's open from Monday through Saturday, 10 to 8, and Sundays, 10 to 5.
Lucy the Elephant, my love to you.
As local theatre communities begin preparations for the beginning of their new season, there's at least one regional enclave that's been going strong all summer long. Now Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at the vibrant theatre scene on the southern tip of New Jersey.
South of Atlantic City, there's not much professional theater along the shore. In fact, it's virtually non-existent, with the exception of Cape May. Perhaps best known for its ubiquitous Victorian architecture, the beach town is home to two established theater companies. Founded in 1980, the East Lynn Theater Company specializes in producing American stage classics. Gail Stahlhuth is artistic director.
Theater in Cape May is definitely thriving. Our audiences were up 30% last year over the year before.
The other theater in town, the Cape May Stage, is led by artistic director Michael Carlton. He's also upbeat about the state of theater in Cape May.
This is our 18th season, and for the past 5 years, we've experienced phenomenal growth. We've basically almost doubled our attendance and box office in the past 5 years, and every year we're able to do slightly bigger productions, pay the artists a bit more, and our audience base has steadily increased.
Demonstrated by the success of the Cape May Stage and East Lynn, there appears to be an appetite for theater at the shore. But with so few professional theaters along the southern New Jersey coast, how did Cape May come to support two companies? 83-year-old Bruce Minix was mayor of Cape May from 1972 to 1976. The retired television producer, writer, and director remembers the days when movies were about the only form of entertainment in town, besides the beach.
If you had lived here in 1968, when we moved here year-round, it was a desert. we needed something. We needed it for ourselves. And I think that's still one of the factors that's controlling all of this, because the people who move to Cape May and decide they love it and decide they want to stay are generally fairly sophisticated people, and they're used to having good entertainment.
In many cases, cultivating sophistication involves money. And Michael Carlton frankly admits that Cape May tends to attract wealthy residents.
I think people tend to associate, you know, money and culture. I mean, it shouldn't be that way. Everybody should be able to have theater and arts and music and film festivals, but it doesn't really follow.
As a nonprofit organization, Carlton's Cape May stage doesn't generate very much revenue with ticket sales. In fact, like many theaters, over half of the company's budget comes from grants, private donations, and corporate sponsors. Carlton suggests that few vibrant theaters pop up in the region because they need the support of businesses, which aren't in abundance beyond a shore town like Cape May.
A lot of South Jersey is rural and agricultural, so you don't have anybody to pick up the tab.
While attendance numbers are up and donors continue to support the Cape May stage and the Eastland Company, it is by no means all smooth sailing for the theaters. For years, one of the biggest hurdles has been the lack of venues. In general, artistic performances in the area take place in churches, hotels, and gymnasiums. The Cape May stage is finally in the process of converting an old church into a more conventional theater space. Renovations are slated for completion next year. But Gail Stahlhoff says the East Lynn Theater Company, which performs in Cape May's First Presbyterian Church, hasn't had such luck in securing their own space, although they've come close in recent years.
And it's broken my heart several times to come close, but, you know, real estate by the shore is very expensive right now. We have not given up, and in the meantime, we've actually had other venues be known to us that are outside of Cape May County and outside of Cape May. And the decision so far from the Board of Trustees of the East Lynn Theater Company is to try to keep finding a place here. So, in essence, we have turn down other venues at the risk of staying here and still hoping to find a permanent home.
The difficulty of finding a good performance space is one downside to doing theater in Cape May. However, the nearby beaches and surrounding Victoriana might make up for that inconvenience. Michael Carlton says the shore culture helps to pull in good acting talent from Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, and even the West Coast.
I think a lot of these really, really fine actors come here because they know we do good work, and they know they get, you know, their days off at the beach. They'd call me up and say, hey, you got something for me this summer? I'd love to be down at the beach for the summer. And I'm in a really lucky position that I know a lot of good actors who do want to come here and work for much less than they're worth.
While the beach and Victoriana make Cape May an easy sell during July and August, former Mayor Bruce Minix says town leaders long ago recognized that in order for Cape May to thrive, they needed to find ways to draw visitors outside the traditional beach season.
A big element of that, of course, is the theater.
Indeed, the Cape May theater seasons extend from May to December. In conjunction with events like Victorian Week and a film festival in the fall, the theaters prove to be assets for Cape May. But Michael Carlton notes it's not realistic to think of theater as being a primary incentive for most people to visit, for now.
Down in the shore, it's still the beaches, and in Cape May, the Victoriana. But I think we're beginning to be part of the reason people come. And I want to position the arts, and my theater in particular, as a reason people get here.
Cape May Stage Artistic Director Michael Carlton ending that report by WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Price by Arthur Miller, featuring Robert Prodsky and his sons, is at the Cape May Stage through September 23rd, while the final performance of the East Lynn Theatre Company's current presentation, Rain, based on Somerset Maugham's story Sadie Thompson, is this evening at 8. The company's next production, Why Marry, by Jesse Lynch Williams, opens on September 20th. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Theresa Madden and myself. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.